Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're trying to get a handle on something incredibly complex: the human stress response, specifically how we measure it using salivary cortisol.
Right, that's the measure of the free, sort of biologically active stress hormone.
But the big problem, the real headache for researchers, is just how wildly different those cortisol levels can be, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Huge variability. Not just between different people, but even within the same person. It changes constantly depending on the situation, time of day, hormones.
Makes it tough to interpret the signal through all that noise.
Exactly. So much noise.
So our mission today is basically to act as a guide through that complexity. We've dug into a load of scientific reviews to find the, let's call them, the secret levers controlling this variability.
We'll want to turn this pretty dense science into something clear and memorable for you, focusing on what makes your stress response potentially unique.
Okay, so first things first. The system we're talking about is the HPA axis, right? Hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis.
That's the one, the body's main stress control center. And the tool researchers keep coming back to, the sort of go-to method, is the Trier Social Stress Test, the TSST.
Right, the TSST. You see the acronym everywhere in this field. What makes it the gold standard? Why is it so effective?
Well, it's really good at reliably getting that cortisol response going. It works because it combines two key elements, a feeling of uncontrollability and what they call social evaluative threat.
Social evaluative threat,
Well,
meaning you feel judged and you can't really control the situation.
precisely. You're typically asked to give a speech totally unprepared in front of people who look, well, unimpressed, maybe even critical. Then you do some tough mental math, all while being told they're analyzing your stress signals.
Sounds awful.
It is. But that combination, it kind of bypasses our usual coping mechanisms and hits the HPA axis hard. That's why it generates such a measurable cortisol spike.
Okay, so that's how they measure it. Now let's get into what makes those measurements vary so much. The biggest factor, the most consistent finding, seems to be biological sex.
Yeah, that's probably the clearest difference we see across decades of research. Men show significantly larger salivary cortisol spikes in response to these short-term psychosocial stressors compared to women.
And we're not talking a small difference here. The numbers are pretty stark. Men might show, what, a 200 to 400% increase from their baseline?
Easily. Whereas women often show a much smaller increase, maybe only 50% to 150%. It's a really substantial gap.
Which points towards hormones.
Definitely. Female physiology, particularly the menstrual cycle phase, has a huge impact. So women tested in their luteal phase, that's the second half of the cycle, often have stress responses much closer to men's.
Okay, but what about the follicular phase, or women taking oral contraceptives, birth control pills?
Right, that's where you see a really significant blunting of the response, much lower cortisol spikes.
The oral contraceptive link is fascinating. It's not immediately obvious why birth control would dampen your stress reaction. What's the mechanism there?
Ah, okay, so this gets into the weeds a bit, but it's a great example of the system's complexity. It involves something called corticosteroid binding globulin, or CBG.
CBG. Okay, break that down for us. For you listening, how should you picture CBG? Like, is it a taxi for cortisol in the blood?
That's a great analogy, actually. Yeah. Cortisol mostly travels bound to CBG, and when it's bound, it's inactive. It has to be dropped off to have an effect.
And oral contraceptives.
The synthetic estrogen in many OCs causes the liver to produce way more CBG, so you have many more of these taxis.
Meaning more cortisol gets bound up,
Yeah.
leaving less free cortisol floating around to be measured in saliva or to act on tissues.
Exactly. The total cortisol might still go up under stress, but the free active amount, the part that triggers the physiological response and that we measure in saliva, is much lower because it's being mopped up by all that extra CBG. It fundamentally changes the measurement.
Interesting. Okay, let's shift gears to age. Does our stress reactivity change as we get older? Does it mellow out?
It's complicated. Depends how you measure it. Studies using psychological stress, like the TSST, give mixed results, maybe slightly higher responses in older men sometimes, but not consistently dramatic.
But if you use drugs to stimulate the system.
Right. If you use pharmacological challenges, basically injecting something that directly triggers the HPA axis, then you do often see higher, more prolonged responses in older adults, both men and women.
So the machinery, the HPA axis itself, might become more sensitive or slower to shut off with age, even if the psychological trigger doesn't always cause a bigger reaction.
That's one interpretation, yeah. And what's also really interesting is how early life factors seem to tune this system. Things like low birth weight have been linked to lower cortisol responses in adulthood. It suggests our stress thermostat might be set very early on.
Wow, okay. And what about pregnancy and just after birth?
Pregnancy generally seems to dampen the cortisol response to a stressful challenge. Makes sense. Protecting the fetus, perhaps. And after birth, there's a really specific effect. The act of suckling during breastfeeding seems to cause a short-term suppression of the mom's cortisol response to stress.
A temporary buffer during feeding.
Seems like it.
Okay, so we've got the biological basics, age, sex, hormones. But what about things we do? Our lifestyle choices, substances we use.
Yeah.
They must tweak the HPA axis too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Big time. What you consume can have pretty immediate and also long-term effects. Let's talk about nicotine first. There's a bit of a paradox there.
The nicotine paradox, right. So acutely, like right after smoking a cigarette or two, it actually stimulates cortisol.
Yeah, it's a potent acute stimulator. You see cortisol levels jump pretty significantly right after smoking.
But habitual smokers, people who smoke regularly.
That's the twist. When you put habitual smokers through a stress test like the TSST, they tend to show a blunted response, lower cortisol spikes compared to non-smokers.
So chronic use seems to make the HPA axis less reactive to other stressors.
It appears so. Like the system adapts or becomes somewhat desensitized over time due to the chronic stimulation. It's a really important factor for researchers to track.
Definitely. Okay, what about caffeine, the other daily essential for many?
Caffeine on its own can nudge cortisol up a bit, but the interesting part is the combination effect. If you have caffeine and you're stressed psychologically or you're exercising, the effects tend to add up, sometimes even synergistically.
So caffeine can amplify your stress response.
It seems to compound it, yes.
Now, this next one really surprised me. The role of food, specifically glucose or blood sugar.
Yes, this is crucial, especially for how research is conducted. Your nutritional state is a major HPA regulator, and it's kind of counterintuitive. We often think low blood sugar makes us feel stressed or hangry.
Right.
But physiologically, low glucose levels seem to actually inhibit the HPA axis response to a purely psychological stressor like the TSST.
Hold on. So if you haven't eaten, your body won't mount as big a cortisol response to public speaking anxiety.
That's what the research suggests. It's like the body prioritizes energy. A big cortisol surge uses resources. If glucose, the main fuel, is low, the system might hold back unless it's a truly life-threatening physical stressor.
And the flip side.
The flip side is studies show if you give people a glucose load before the TSST, their cortisol response is significantly greater than subjects who were fasted or just drank water.
So, wow. For researchers, this means you absolutely have to control for whether participants have eaten recently or what their blood sugar's like.
You have to. Otherwise, you might just be measuring the effect of energy availability, not the psychological stress itself. You could end up doing a nutrition study by accident.
Fascinating. Okay, last one in this section. Alcohol. Acutely, it might calm nerves, but what about chronic use?
Chronic heavy drinking, and even just having a family history of alcoholism, is generally linked to blunted HPA axis responses to stress. Again, maybe indicating some long-term desensitization.
Though it's not totally clear-cut.
No, not entirely. Some studies, for instance, have found heightened responses in sons of alcoholic fathers, suggesting there might be complex interactions between genetic predispositions and exposure. It's still an active area of research.
Okay, let's move to our final section. Context. Psychology, the testing environment itself. Things like getting used to the stressor habituation.
Yes, habituation is a big one. If you bring people back and put them through the same stress test, say the TSST, multiple times, most people's cortisol response gets smaller each time.
The body learns it's not actually dangerous.
Kind of. It adapts. But, and this is key, not everyone habituates. The studies show maybe about half do, but a significant chunk, maybe around 16%, actually show sensitization. Their response gets bigger with repeated exposure.
Bigger. Why would that happen?
It suggests that for some people, the repetition reinforces the feeling of failure or threat. They might anticipate it more, dread it more, internalize the negative social evaluation more deeply each time. It becomes more stressful because they remember failing before.
So one person learns, I can handle this, while another learns, this is where I always mess up. That's a huge difference in psychology driving the physiology.
Exactly. And this ties into personality too. Personality traits don't seem to strongly predict the first cortisol response to a novel stressor very well, but they become much better predictors of how someone responds after they've been exposed repeatedly. It's about how you cope and learn from the experience.
What about the time of day? We know cortisol is naturally high in the morning. Does that mess up the measurements?
It definitely affects the absolute levels. Your baseline cortisol is higher in the morning, so the whole curve is shifted upwards. But importantly, you can still get reliable measurements of the increase, the net change from baseline in the afternoon.
So as long as you focus on the size of the spike relative to where that person started right before the stressor.
Exactly. Measuring the change works pretty well in the afternoon, which is often more convenient for labs anyway. Standardization is key.
Let's talk social environment. Does having support help buffer the stress response?
You'd think so, and for men, it often does. Studies show brief social support before the TSST significantly lowered cortisol responses in men.
But for women,
It's more complex. Some studies actually found women showed slightly higher cortisol responses when they were supported by their male partners during the TSST.
higher. That seems counterintuitive. Why would support potentially increase stress for women in that context?
Well, it's debated. Maybe the type of support matters, or maybe the partner's presence added another layer of evaluation or pressure in that specific stressful task. It really highlights that social support isn't a simple fix. Its effect can be modulated by gender and context.
And social status. Does where you perceive yourself in a hierarchy matter?
It seems to. There was that study with army recruits. The ones who were identified as more socially dominant had significantly higher cortisol increases after the TSST compared to those lower in the hierarchy.
So being top dog might make you more physiologically reactive to a social threat. Maybe because there's more status to lose.
That's a plausible interpretation. High status might come with a greater physiological investment in defending that status when challenged socially.
Okay, finally, the timing within the stress response itself, the feeling versus the hormone.
Crucial point. That feeling of panic or anxiety, that hits within seconds. But cortisol, being a hormone that needs to be produced and released, it takes time. The peak in saliva usually occurs about 15 to 20 minutes after the stressor started.
So researchers need to collect samples, not just during the stress, but well afterwards to capture the peak hormonal reaction.
Absolutely. You need to understand those system dynamics. What you feel and what your HPA axis is doing are on slightly different timelines.
Okay, so let's pull this all together. We've gone through biology, lifestyle, context. What's the big picture for you, the listener?
The main point is that all this variability in stress responses, it isn't just random static. It's the outcome of a whole bunch of factors interacting: your genes, your hormones, your environment, your behavior, your history.
And understanding this is clinically important, right? Because abnormal HPA axis responses are linked to various conditions.
Yes, conditions like major depression, PTSD, chronic fatigue syndrome often show characteristic patterns in cortisol stress responses, but sometimes these only become clear when you actually challenge the system, like with a TSST. It helps reveal underlying dysregulation.
So the key takeaway for you listening, if you're trying to understand stress research or even thinking about your own physiology, remember those big modulators. The two things researchers absolutely have to control for, the factors setting the stage for the response size, are time of day and sex hormonal status, like menstrual phase or OC use.
Get those wrong, and the signal gets completely lost in the noise.
Definitely. Control for those, and you improve the signal-to-noise ratio dramatically.
And maybe a final thought to chew on. We've seen that things from way back, like your birth weight, seem to tune your HPA axis. And things happening now, like your social standing or support network, also shape it.
So, how much of your reaction to today's stressor, that looming deadline, that awkward conversation, is actually about the stressor itself?
Versus how much is predetermined by a biological blueprint set decades ago, interacting with your current social reality. It really makes you think about the deep roots of our stress responses.